saw him until shortly before trial. And when he did see him, he said, they would not have been satisfactory to me, much less Mr. Dent. He has too much things in there that we never discussed.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
Did they purchase any equipment or ship any equipment?
They did not.
Or deny any sales to anybody else in Europe of any equipment? Were they out anything?
Exactly my question, only I worded it this way. Are you out one dime or one nickel? And he says, no, we're not. But he said, hey, we might get sued. Now, bear in mind, trial was a number of years afterwards. And I said, have you been sued? He said, no. I said, are you out anything? He says, no, I'm not. And so that was raised clearly at the trial that my client, when he wrote him a letter, and the letter is an exhibit, in November, when he thought this man was a charlatan because he was selling us rides for $500,000 less than we had had offered for about a year, we ended up buying for $500,000 more. But we thought, because he didn't produce the contract and there was some personal circumstance that my client had death in the family and had to leave New Orleans, we never saw the documentation. So the record shows Poulison called my client's office to give condolences on the airplane crash desk and said, I'm shipping rides. And Mr. Baker's testimony in the record reveals, he says, wait, we don't have a deal. Don't ship anything. You don't have a purchase order. So Poulison got out of all that. Back to your original question, they did not incur any expense. But then carrying it further, when my client came in from the funeral, Mr. Dipp, and I talked to Baker, they composed a letter that says, we withdraw from no negotiations. No further negotiations with you, because the man jumped the gun. I asked him at the trial, I said, when you came to El Paso in October, and you put that provision about subject to legal documentation and so forth, why didn't you fly to Houston to go get with the lawyer and get that part of the contract done before you went and got some rides lined up? And he says, well, I had something else to do. So instead, he sends his telexes from, he sent the telexes, I think, from Belgium to the Houston lawyer. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but anyway, he sent them, and it clearly shows that he contemplated, as did my client, that a lawyer named Skip Scoggins would examine it for our side, and that there would be no binding deal until and unless and subject to satisfactory legal documentation. Mr. Poulison, in his testimony, says, I understood that too. That's why the Court of Appeals reversed and rendered. The plaintiff had not pled waiver and estoppel of something in the contract that amounted to a clear condition. The testimony at the trial showed that there was no waiver and estoppel. The petitioner could not even plead waiver and estoppel had they wanted to. Why? Because they're honest, capable lawyers, and the facts did not show that there was a waiver and estoppel. Under the interpretation of the contract, the court had a duty to direct a verdict for GRD. We moved for a directed verdict. The court denied it. Finally, the Court of Appeals recognized what we all see, that this was a case where, just looking at the contract and by the admissions of the petitioner, they hadn't fulfilled an essential term of the contract. The petitioner offered no excuse for it. He didn't say, well, you guys waived it. He didn't say, well, you're stopped because you did this or that. They ignored that. They just disregarded it. So we have a situation where, as a matter of contract construction, if you look at Coker versus Coker, Allied Bank of Texas versus Plaza DeVille, 733 Second 566, not in our brief, but it's a case that follows it, and the decisions that we cite in our appellate brief on contract interpretation, to follow petitioner's position, you have to do away with all those cases and say, we're not going to follow this particular term of the contract. I welcome any other questions. I don't want to keep the court from its rounds and duties and vacation, and I too welcome the opportunity that this case be advanced. We're hoping for an early decision. We have up our supersedious bond for $500,000. The premium continues. I did get a call from Oxford and London asking me to oppose Mr. McMahon's motion, but I figured we would get him out of this country as quick as we can, and thank you for your attention.
May it please the court. I believe that perhaps the anomaly of the position taken both by the respondent and by the El Paso Court of Appeals is perhaps best illustrated by some of respondent counsel's own arguments in terms of their framing. Counsel says repeatedly, this contract is not ambiguous. The holding of the Court of Appeals was there was no contract. The argument of the respondent throughout the proceedings was that there was no contract. His argument therefore basically puts the horse before the cart. Or after, actually is without a horse at all. Because the point and sole point of contention in this case is, was there a contract? Because prior to the ability to perform with regards to the fourth provision of such contract, which petitioner has never attempted to read out of the contract, the argument throughout was that there was repudiation by the other side before compliance. And the UCC in 2609 and 10 provide a measure of damages for a repudiation and a total excuse from all further performance. It's not something that has to be pled. It is the measure of damages that is utilized. This is a suit for anticipatory breach. It is a repudiation case. The measure of damages and damages sought had nothing to do with reliance damages, although there is testimony of performance or the commencement of performance, including, obviously, the procurement of the lawyers specified in the contract who were working on the more formalized documents and essentially were financial people, incidentally, and that was one of the things, I mean, they were working on the financial documentation with regards to the UCC-1 financing statements. Because vis-a-vis Mr. Dipp, the buyer in that case, that it was basically those security instruments that were going to be the security for the actual purchase of the rides in question. So that the question here was not were there any of these other kinds of damages, reliance damages, estoppel, waiver, none of that comes in. The point is they repudiated the contract. The question is before that, is there a contract? Throughout the argument of my opposition, and as embodied in the Court of Appeals opinion, there is this inconsistency of, well, let's talk about these facts, and at the same time, this position that, well, we can't talk about the facts. We can talk about them when they support the proposition that we want to argue, but you can't talk about them in the question as to whether or not there is a contract. And that is the issue that is addressed and dealt with in the UCC, which says you do consider the surrounding circumstances. Even in ordinary contract law, you consider the surrounding circumstances and the subject matter of the agreement. That's not to vary the terms of the agreement. It is to show the intention of the parties to form a contract. And that's the sole issue in dispute. Repudiation, while it was submitted to the jury, probably didn't need to be submitted at all, for it is undisputed that there was withdrawal by the other side, that they said, no, we're not going forward. Not because, and contrary to some inference that was made here, there is no testimony that they did that because they had not received the legal documentation further that they had anticipated. There is no argument that can be made on this record as to that being an argument. There is no question that we did not have and had not had a sufficient reasonable time in which to prepare the more formalizing documents that we were talking about. But that's later on down the road. The entire essence of a repudiation notion is if you have a contract and then you have repudiation, then you are excused from further performance if you elect to treat that as canceled and may sue for what you would have gained by benefit under the contract. That is what the UCC provisions 2609 and 10 provide. That is your measure of damages, and that is the basis and predicate for this litigation.
What's not about it? The man says that there's nothing to repudiate. There's no contract to repudiate.
That is the essence of what the argument should be, but I think the court can see why it is probably that the jury didn't buy the arguments that were asserted by counsel, and why, in my judgment, this court should not. And that is because consistently there is talk about, well, you can't read provision 4 out of the contract. And that's the point. There is a contract. There was an agreement by the parties. They did intend to be bound, and in fact, and I think that this is very significant, the inclusion of the fact that the legal expenses were in fact to be borne by GRD, and that was to be commenced immediately. They were the ones that were in preparing the documentation. The immediate performance under the contract was clearly contemplated. Immediate legal obligation was clearly contemplated. That was merely a provision of the agreement. And as...
Sir, what would have happened if your client could not have gotten...
Well, then arguably we would have been in breach of the contract, and to the extent that there were damages to the other side, then they certainly could have sued us under the agreement, and we do not deny that. The code does not permit speculative assessment of what would or wouldn't be, although there is evidence...
That was not a condition, then, you're saying.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was obligated to get financing no matter how.
And in fact, of course, there is a jury finding that he was ready, willing, and able to perform, so that if there were some argument to be made about that, there was clear opportunity to argue.
I was saying if the reverse situation had taken place.
How do you distinguish this type of situation from real estate contract that said subject to financing? And I'm thinking of the financing, you don't have a deal. There is no contract.
Well, in two respects. Number one, of course, ordinarily you have an escrow agreement by which you have forfeited a fairly substantial sum of money, which is established by the parties to be the liquidated damages for the non-completion of it. And number two is that the condition situation in real estate agreements is simply different than the UCC. The UCC is a predominant force here in its sections, as we have cited in the briefing, especially in sections 2.207 and 2.204, make it very clear that the question of the intent of the parties to be bound is a question to be determined from the surrounding facts and circumstances of the transaction, for the simple reason that sales of goods transactions, the reasoning for the UCC and its predominance was we need to establish some stability for the commerce in this area. Individual real estate transactions are much more specific. Now, I do not deny in any respect the argument that you can override general provisions of the UCC by specific provisions in your agreement. Of course, that is what the power to contract is. But that does not in any way militate against the seminal question of fact that even in transactions as monstrous as the Texaco or in the Getty Pennzoil transaction that caused the court in that case to hold specifically, as I quoted in my brief, that although the intent to formalize an agreement is some evidence of an intent not to be bound before signing such a writing, it is not conclusive. The issue of when the parties intended to be bound is a fact question to be decided from the parties' acts and communications. It was submitted to the jury in this case. It was determined in Ferreca's favor. That is the fact question. This case is in many respects similar to Island Recreation, not because there is a waiver issue, because of course the issue in Island Recreation in part and the contention that was made, as this court I'm sure recalls, was that waiver needed to be separately submitted rather than the compliance issue that actually was submitted. The majority holds in Island Recreation that waiver is wrapped into the entire notion of compliance. Well, there is no question in this particular case that the real question here is even more fundamental and clearly submitted, and that is, was there an agreement, and by that meaning an intent to be legally bound to an agreement? The argument by the other side is, well, yes, we did, but we had this provision in it that wasn't complied with, but we repudiated before you could. If they get that far, if they get to the point that there is this agreement, and the complaint that we wanted to ignore it, we're not reading it out. Their repudiation precluded it. At that point, it ceases to be a factor in the case. It isn't a question of waiver or estoppel. It is the essence of the theory of repudiation upon which the recovery was predicated, and upon which these damages, my judgment, should be reinstated, and the trial court judgment and jury verdict affirmed.
Do you ever, can you see in any contract where the condition precedent language is so obvious on the face of it that a court would be entitled as a matter of law to say that there was no immediate intent to be bound, therefore it would have been improper to submit the issue to the jury?
Yes, I there's no question that I cannot say in absolute terms that it is never a question solely of law for the court as to whether the parties intended to be bound. Okay. If there is no dispute in the evidence.
But in this case, you say that the language in the contract does not evidence an intent to be bound as a matter of law. Excuse me, back that up. That the language in the contract as a matter of law does not state the condition proceeds.
I'm saying the only way the El Paso Court of Appeals reversal can be sustained is if this court holds that there is no factual inquiry permissible.
And you say that in some cases that would be true, that there would be no factual inquiry permissible.
Well, when there is no factual dispute, obviously no factual inquiry by definition, by tautology.
You mean you can have a contract where you say this contract will not be binding. Neither party has any obligation to act on it until we do this. And if somebody stands up in trial and says, no, we didn't mean that, that creates a factual dispute?
No, I don't believe that. I'm not suggesting that if you write a writing that says this is not an agreement, that you can somehow convert that into an agreement by oral testimony. But what
I
am...
Well, I agree with that.
Right.
And so the question is the subject to, is that enough to say that...
Except that, again, the focus of the code and the focus, for that matter, of the common law is not, as in Hudson versus Wakefield, is not to construe these as conditions, but to construe them, in essence, as covenants, as promises. Obviously, we had promised to perform. Did we not perform? Were we guilty of breach? By not reducing the documents to writing, we would be contractually liable. And that's the reverse side of the coin. We're willing to accept that liability. We were willing to accept that liability. We did undertake that responsibility. We were precluded in its performance by the repudiation of the other party. And our so-called delay in the immediate performance of the formalization was never, under the testimony in this record, was never an issue with regards to the decision to repudiate. It's actually a vastly more complicated personal problem with regards to Mr. Dipp as to why he said what we were and who some people that he was dealing with were and a number of other various and sundry excuses, but that was absolutely immaterial. Those are not the issues. It was not, no claim was ever made that we were in breach by not having provided the paperwork any earlier. Though such a claim, if we had delayed further, could have been asserted, and in my judgment would have stated a contractual claim because there was an agreement. If their position is true, that there is never an enforceable agreement, then we never had to do it, and there would have been no requirement to do any of this. But the agreement itself executed contemplated immediate commencement and contemplated the allocation of the costs of the preparation of the formal documents to GRD, to the buyer, who said, well, I wasn't going to pay them unless I signed the contract ultimately. But he had already signed an instrument saying, I will pay the legal expenses incurred in regards to this documentation. And he now wishes to say, no immediate performance. We were just going to worry about whether or not we got to do that later. I could just by my unilateral act of not signing, or an even more unilateral act of not paying, the attorneys could have precluded the performance of that condition, and it is his position that that's not a contractual breach.
What about the argument that's made that in the documentation it was important to look at the documentation because you had inserted, your side had inserted some terms that were totally unacceptable, like waivers of the EPA.
There are no questions, Your Honor, that there were, that this was in a draft stage at the time of the repudiation. There is no question that there had not been sufficient time for full formalization of all of the terms by the parties from the standpoint, again, of formalization. Again, the UCC in 207 and 204 speaks to the issue of other additional terms that are not essential to the agreement, which can always be agreed or added to or modified later.
But this was to the gut of the agreement, whether or not there was going to be a warranty.
Judge, those are precisely the arguments made in the Texaco argument, in the Getty Pennzoil, that there were many, numerous disputes, that there were in fact five different drafts of the memorandums of agreement, none of which had ever been signed between Getty and Pennzoil, and that there were differences in the numbers, in fact to the tune of $60 million in the upfront consideration at some point. But nonetheless, the court says there is nonetheless a fact issue for reasons that are analogous to and were relied upon by Pennzoil, the reference to the obligation to negotiate and deal in good faith and fairly, which is in the UCC. The position of Texaco was, wait a minute, that's not a UCC transaction. Position here is just the opposite. It is a UCC transaction, and both parties have a duty of good faith to attempt to complete the formalization process. And if they don't do so, if they are in breach of that duty, that is a breach under the UCC of the contract that is actionable. And that's the point. We have a contract, we have an action, we have a verdict, and we submit we should have a judgment. Thank you.
The foregoing case is submitted on briefs and oral arguments that concludes the business of the court. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Yeah.